Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Before we get to our first guest, I gotta warn you, some of the views and terms expressed are solely those of the individual and not necessarily those of anyone at CJAM 99.1 FM. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Christine Gray Desarn, founder of the Polycystic Ovarian Syndrome Association. So tell me a little bit about the Polycystic Ovarian Syndrome Association.
Well, the Polycystic Ovarian Syndrome Association was founded in 1997, and it's largely a grassroots organization that was born out of the frustration of lacking information on the medical condition of PCOS. And they immediately became a 501c3. Back in the day, we were pretty well funded through pharmaceutical companies, et cetera. So we were able to pay some staff, but the pharma guidelines that came along from passed by the U.S. Congress cut that off about 6 years ago. So we are an all-volunteer organization, and we serve a huge constituency of women with PCOS, approximately 5 million women in the United States, but we have no border, where we serve women around the world who are connected to the internet.
So how does PCOS typically affect a person?
Well, PCOS is very poorly named. It's actually a hormonal condition or an endocrine condition that affects multiple systems throughout the body. One of the many symptoms is polycystic ovary, but not all women with PCOS, actually with a hormonal condition, actually have that particular symptom. So one of the issues that we sometimes have is the poor naming of the condition misleads people into thinking it's a completely a gynecological type of condition, but it's not. It's actually a form of prediabetes or syndrome X, as some people might, it's kind of an offshoot, I should say. Although not all women with PCOS have weight issues with weight gain, but fundamentally, PCOS starts with insulin resistance, the lack of cells in the body to be able to process sugar effectively because of the insulin doesn't work the way it should. And that makes the body produce more insulin than it needs, and that produces a cascade of hormonal meltdown, if you will, and it causes increases in women's levels of male hormones that causes symptoms like hair growth on the body and on the face for women. It also causes hair loss right where they want it, on the scalp, adult acne, and other skin conditions. At the same time, the high levels of insulin reduce or change the balance of female hormones, and women frequently stop ovulating, or if they do ovulate, the timing is off, and it makes it difficult for women to become pregnant, and also increases the risk of developing endometrial cancer, because some women with PCOS don't have menstrual cycles at all. So as you can see, it's a quite a comprehensive condition that affects multiple systems throughout the body, but it all starts with that insulin, high levels of insulin or hyperinsulinemia, as doctors call it.
So are there any potential treatments available?
Well, the primary treatment for PCOS is diet and exercise. And some women with PCOS are able to control it and manage PCOS completely, and they live symptom-free, but a low-glycemic diet is at the center of that treatment path. There are also some medications that help sensitize women to insulin, one of them being a medication called metformin, which has been on the market for diabetes for many years. But can also be prescribed for PCOS, even though it's not FDA approved. It's an off-label, what doctors call an off-label prescription. Some of the other treatments, there are many treatments for the individual symptoms, such as causing menstrual cycles to appear with birth control pills and other types of hormonal treatments. However, those don't get to the core of the problem. And so what we always recommend to our constituents is to handle the core of the problem through diet, sometimes through supplements and through medication, whatever the combination is that works for the individual, and then to tackle as a secondary measure the different symptoms that are most bothersome to them.
So, in your time with the association, what sorts of challenges have you seen?
Well, the challenges with the association lie around the lacking funding. So, PCOS is not what I would term a sexy condition, and by that I mean the conditions that people who are donating funds to that are most attractive to them tend to revolve around children and several of the cancers, et cetera, which are certainly very, very worthy causes. But we find that having a gynecological-sounding condition tends to put us on the back burner as far as large funding efforts go within the communities around the United States. We also have, as I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, we've had issues because pharmaceutical companies don't have any drugs out there today that are, there are no drugs on the market today that are indicated by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States for PCOS, and the pharma companies have gotten their hands slapped from supporting nonprofit organizations that represent medical conditions where they don't have a drug for that condition officially, and this has caused them to pull back. So with one of the problems we have is that we just don't have enough people and resource to operate without people, such as automation, in a truly healthy way, as an organization goes.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the association, is there any one success that stood out for you?
Well, I feel that we've made tremendous progress on our mission from the beginning. At the beginning, there were no resources online for women with PCOS. There were no newsletters or books on the topic, and we really shined the light on PCOS first through of all magazines, Cosmopolitan attended our inaugural conference and published the first article we know of on PCOS. And that continued with Good Housekeeping and others throughout those early years. And since that time, the number of books and publications and websites and blogs from people have really proliferated. And that's very exciting to us. And ultimately, our goal would be to obsolete ourselves so that there is no organization really needed for the purpose of bringing about awareness or education. But what we're most proud of are the stories of lives that have been saved and of children that have been born that would not have been otherwise born, or at least that's what's believed. In a couple of cases, we believe that, you know, it's been reported to us that women have approached a doctor immediately after reading about one of our stories or hearing about one of our programs, and we had an appearance on Dateline NBC back in 1999. We've had a number of people tell us that prompted them to see a doctor when they wouldn't have, and that they had cancer. They had already developed endometrial cancer, and there were no symptoms that they were aware of, but our outreach got them diagnosed and treated, and they're alive today because of it.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for the association?
Yes, there is a technical project, but we have a long-term and short-term plan to really build out our online resources and our online community so that patients feel very comfortable with the privacy and the individual support that they can receive within that online community. Not like a Facebook or a social media type of situation, but a place where their individual concerns as patients with PCOS are responded to. For instance, a teenager with PCOS has a very different set of interests than a postmenopausal woman with PCOS, and a different set of needs, and even just a different way that they need to be addressed or spoken to. And our goal is to expand and create that environment using customer relationship management and other technology that is current to make that a truly more valuable resource for her and to help support her lifestyle and needs that she needs to adhere to for the success of her treatment.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Just a reminder, folks, some of the views and terms expressed in the preceding interview were solely those of the individual and don't necessarily reflect those of anybody at CJAM Radio. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
For all you artists out there, Leamington is hosting the Leamington Stand Strong Art Competition, centered around its unique history and food. Artists are encouraged to submit 2D or 3D creations that share a positive message about Leamington, a vibrant and unique food-producing community. Submissions must not be later than March 1st at 4 p.m. For more information, or to submit artwork, go to leamingtonstandstrong.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Christine Gray Desarn, founder of the Polycystic Ovarian Syndrome Association. So tell me a little bit about your background in disability research.
I guess I'll go first. Emil and I both have quite an extensive background in studying the lives of injured workers, and that is what has led us into the broader disability field. A lot of the injured workers who we've encountered and who we've seen through our research studies have been injured at work and gone on to workers' compensation and had some challenges with eligibility, ended up on disability benefits and the like. I've also had experience studying community integration of people with developmental disabilities and some of the challenges around that too.
And I'm Emil Topp. I've done a lot of research with Ellen as well on community-based research projects with the injured work community here in Ontario. I led a six-year project with them looking at the consequences of work injury. And we found that a lot of the injured workers, as Ellen pointed out, were bouncing between different disability support programs. You know, they got cut off of workers' comp, they went on to social assistance or tried to be eligible for Canada Pension Plan disability. They struggled for many years just to get the support they needed to sustain their lives, and barring even issues of trying to think about getting back to the labor market, just being eligible for supports was a struggle for them.
So, what sorts of methods can society use to provide adequate supports?
Well, one of the challenges now is that the program providers are facing the challenge that they talk about a lot about their programs becoming too expensive. How can we cut costs? We can't afford this. More and more people are trying to, you know, gain access to these income support programs, and they're sort of raising the walls. And one of our perspectives is that perhaps rather than raising the walls higher and creating more gates, there could be a different way of thinking about the challenge of disability and employment. And instead of encouraging people to focus more and more strongly on trying to prove over and over again how disabled they are, could we perhaps have a way of thinking about a system that would focus on what kind of support people need just to get back to work?
Yeah, and the programs, the way they're designed now, for all or nothing, like workers' compensation, if you don't become eligible for that, the other programs are only eligible when you're wholly or substantially disabled, and there's no opportunity to try to integrate the supports with transitioning back into the labor market. And they're very nominal amounts. Like Canada Pension Plan Disability is just over $1,000 a month, though ODSD is about $1,000 a month, so they're well below the poverty line.
Yeah, it's pretty hard if you're living on that amount of money, even to just get a decent haircut and pay the bus fare to go to a job interview. It's a bit of a trap.
And then employers are often seeing these things as things they purchase or passive purchasers of disability insurance programs, and they need to play a more active role too. Studies have shown that a lot of the barriers are really just social and stigma barriers. It doesn't require any accommodation on the part of employers for 50% of people with disabilities. And another 34% only require less than $500 of an investment up front for to be accommodated.
And how would you go about educating these employers about these accommodations?
Well, one of the aspects of our center is called the Center for Research and Work Disability Policy, and if anyone's interested in looking us up, it's crwdp.ca, is that we have brought together a broad coalition of researchers across Canada and partners, and our partners include employers, but they also include program providers, insurers, labor community, and community organizations. And so we will be holding policy roundtables. We will be gathering evidence-based knowledge about these issues. And our job with our national organization is to try to get some of these topics onto the public agenda. And maybe you want to talk about our champions as
yes,
well.
Yes, as well, we have a number of champions who are, you know, public figureheads, well known to the various communities. Like we had David Onyo, our lieutenant governor, speak at our launch last week. Mike Bradley, who's the mayor of Sarnia, has been spearheading employing people with disabilities in municipal services. They're the spokespeople who are telling, you know, the public about the kinds of work we're doing and how there's lots of win-win opportunities for employers and society when we engage people in the labor market and more fully in all parts of society. So, you know, if we realize that we can get past these social and stigma barriers, you know, there's a lot of talented people out there who could be very productive for employers if they were given the opportunity to gain employment.
What are the most common challenges faced by these individuals with disabilities?
One of the big challenges that I found is that people who can't work because they have a health problem or disability are sort of up against providers and other important people who have control over resources and programs who sometimes may be suggesting that perhaps these people aren't trying hard enough or they're not motivated enough. And in my research, I've seen that people who really don't think it's very much fun to live on benefits, and it's not much fun being isolated from the community and not being able to go out to work and to participate socially. It's been helpful to be able to illustrate through research the various ways that people want to get engaged in the labor force, but actually because of the way our systems are set up, and the system's never intended to do this, but because of somehow the way things play out through bureaucracy, people end up being trapped in situations where they can't get back into the labor force.
And what we found just with our community-based research is that a lot of the injured workers and people with disabilities that we meet up with spend a lot of their energy just trying to get eligibility for the supports that they need, bumping from program to program. So that consumes a lot of their time. As an economist also, I look at the loss to society, the burden to society of having so many people out of the labor force who can and want to work, and that's a huge cost to society in terms of output and productivity. So there's a lot of gains to be had as a society and for employers to hire these talented people.
And in our national coalitions of researchers, we have people who come from health backgrounds, who are historians, who as economists, who are political scientists, who are epidemiologists, and so we are hoping that by putting together our knowledge and evidence from all of these different directions, that we can bring these together in a forum, discuss the evidence with policymakers, and perhaps start new conversations about these issues.
And it's becoming a more and more of a critical issue as the population ages. When we think about our current situation, 1 in 6 Canadians is over 55, and in a few years it'll be 1 in 4. And invariably, as people age, there's chronic and episodic conditions that come with aging. So we really have to confront this problem soon if we want to continue to be a productive society. Can't have so many people out of the labor force just because we can't provide the supports they need when they can't want to work.
And that's one of our important messages. We're not just talking about a small fringe group of people. We see work disability policy as relevant to everyone.
Yes, and in fact, I remember David Onley, when he was speaking at our launch last week, mentioned that 50% of Canadians are touched by disability, either directly or through someone close in their family. So it touches everybody at some point in their lives.
So, in your work, is there any one success moment for a person with a disability that you've witnessed that stands out?
A success moment?
Yes.
Oh, I can give an example. There was someone who I met, who interviewed, and she was she worked for a municipality in southern Ontario and in one of the nursing homes, and she became injured while she was helping to lift and move a patient. And so she had a back injury. And so she was put into modified work, working in a parking lot. You know those booths that you can sit in a parking lot in the middle of the winter? I mean, it's not a very nice situation, actually, for someone recovering, but that was the modified work that she was put into. And she found that she just wasn't able to recover, and she kept having to take a lot of sick days, and this was leading to disciplinary proceedings. And she was terrified that she would lose her job and her benefits and her pension because of this challenge. And the good news story associated with this also relates to how sometimes people with injuries need to have an advocate with them, a knowledgeable advisor to help them through these processes. The employers have a lot of advice. They have human resource departments, but often workers are on their own with this. In this case, she managed to get in touch with an advisor who went with her to a meeting with her employer to help create an accommodation that would be usable. And it was quite simple. She got a little heater in her parking booth, and because she was having continual back pain, she for her, a TENS machine helped. And when I interviewed her, she said that for the first winter, she'd actually managed to work through the whole winter without taking a day off, and that things were actually looking good. But really, what this is a story of is how it can be very complex for a worker to negotiate these terms with their employers. The worker's in a very vulnerable situation sometimes, and having adequate advice and support can make a big difference.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. It's an interesting situation when it comes to the labor market, isn't it? So many of these people with disabilities want to work, want to express their talents, their gifts in this world. However, they spend so much time focusing on survival, they're not really given the opportunity to live. Being a part of the workforce can be an important part of life. Depends what drives a person. If an individual with a disability wants to be a part of the workforce, wants to take on responsibilities to provide for a family, a home, that should be their right. Sometimes it can be a matter of finding some modification, some adaptation. But as so many of my previous guests have said, it's usually such a very simple thing. And it just has to come from both the employer and the employee. The employee must recognize their own rights and ask for the help that they need. The employer must be willing to say, I want to work with you on this. I believe you can succeed, and I want to help you reach your full potential. But if we as a society continue to limit ourselves, continue to shuffle people out of the workforce simply because the work is done a little bit differently, or because they happen to require some assistance, it's just causing ourselves more problems than we need. The problem isn't that the person has a disability. So that we as a society aren't always keeping enough of an open mind as to say, yes, this can be done. That example about giving that woman a heater, so simple. When it comes to a booth like that, most anybody would want one. We all are responsive to temperature change. It's just a matter of to what degree we feel it, to how we face it. But that's just a basic thing. And sometimes disability life really is the mother of innovation, in that somebody might say, I need this to help me reach my best. And someone else might say, hey, this is a good idea. Why don't we incorporate this across the board? Sometimes it is just a simple matter of thinking what can be done. How can we modify something from the way it is to the way it could be to help a person with a disability reach their best? There's always hope in disability life. What seems to be an insurmountable problem, a hopeless problem, what seemed to be that way 20 years ago, we look at it now and say, in many cases, there is something that can be done. Maybe it's not an immediate cure, but it can be something to improve quality of life. And that's what employers and employees should work together to do for a person with a disability in the workforce. Because when a person has the things they need, the right tools for a job, they can focus on their work, be present in the moment. Odds are they'll be far more likely to give it their best, and to even do better work. A person with a disability, they all have hopes, dreams, capabilities, all their own. And allowing them into the workforce shouldn't be allowing them into the workforce. It should be a matter they're included in the labor market because they are talented people who want to work. And enough of us working together can start to change the landscape of the economy, no matter how damaged it may have become. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HANDILINK, and the number 4, at gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.